Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, OpenAI is offering a more restricted ChatGPT experience for teenagers, and Meta is on trial facing allegations that its platforms were designed to keep young users hooked. What should we think about all of this? Well, we'll talk about it with our technology contributor, George Peck. Plus, it looks like magic, but it's science. We'll visit with our friends from the North Dakota Gateway to Science to answer this question. How can a pin pass through a balloon without popping it? And we begin Main Street today with a closer look with the monitor. As students return to North Dakota schools, the state is rethinking how it uses technology, both in the classroom and later at home. This is a closer look with the monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. We have a two-part closer look with the monitor today. In just a bit, we'll visit with Michael Ochterling, a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor, about growing concerns over screen time and school-issued devices. North Dakota's cell phone ban has changed the atmosphere in many classrooms, but are laptops and tablets creating new distractions? But we begin today's Closer Look with the Monitor with Jeff Beach. He's the deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor. Artificial intelligence, it's already finding its way into North Dakota classrooms, helping students research subjects, develop ideas, and prepare for a world in which AI will likely be a part of everyday life. But the technology also presents risks, particularly when young people turn to AI chatbots for companionship, advice, or help during a crisis. North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction Levi Bachmeyer recently told state lawmakers that schools should retain the flexibility to decide how AI is used for teaching and learning. Instead of broadly regulating AI in schools, he said policymakers should focus on the companies developing these products and the safeguards they provide for children. Jeff, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Jeff, tell me about the superintendent's testimony before the legislative committee.
Yeah, so this committee is a kind of a new committee with kind of two missions. Looking kind of the higher profile part of their charge is data centers, and which have been a hot topic in North Dakota. You know, both the construction and siting and oversight of those, you know, very large, heavy load computer or AI driven centers. But the other part of it is the regulating artificial intelligence in North Dakota, you know, on several fronts. Levi Bachmeyer, the state superintendent of schools, was there to, he really kind of outlined some areas of do's and don'ts that he thinks the legislature should keep in mind as they go forward with possible legislation to regulate artificial intelligence use in the K-12 schools.
He identified companion chatbots as his greatest concern, and according to your reporting, what distinguishes those products from the AI tools students might use for, say, schoolwork?
They really don't have any educational value in Levi's mind. You know, they are just kind of a predictive text kind of product. There have been instances where students, young people, who maybe might be a little bit socially isolated from their peers for whatever reason, have turned to these as kind of a friend, but they are not always offering good advice. Sometimes have even encouraged young people to inflict self-harm, and that's really his main concern. There's really no upside in his mind, and fraught with danger for some, students who may be easily influenced at this point in their life.
Rather than broadly restricting AI in schools, Bachmeyer wants lawmakers to focus on the companies providing it. Why does he favor that approach?
Well, I think he wants to ensure educators, school administrators have the academic freedom to use AI as they best see fit. You know, it's a very rapidly developing technology, and some states have implemented outright bans on AI use in public education, which he says is, you know, going too far, that, you know, AI is an important tool for students to learn how to use and learn how to use it responsibly. So the companies that provide AI is where he would like to see more regulation, especially on these companion chatbots, and just making sure that they are being forthcoming with people, not just students, but everyone that you may be interacting with a non-human voice that seems very human in a chat situation, and you know, making sure that they have guardrails up that keep people's best interests in mind and keep their tools under control. There have been some recent news of like rogue activity by chatbots, even hacking into another company's platform as it tries to seek out answers, which is what it's designed to do. So there have been some interesting developments on trying to rein in what AI can and can't do.
But according to your reporting, he also warned against restricting AI so heavily that students are unprepared for college and the workplace. What educational value does he believe or does he see in allowing students to use AI?
One example he gave is AI is very good at some things. Being able to use it to provide accurate research results. People say AI has a lot of potential in, you know, scanning huge databases, medical research being a big one. And one area where he kind of said maybe North Dakota needs to scale back is computer coding, which North Dakota has put a fairly high emphasis on in public education, teaching kids how to code and opening up potential tech careers. But artificial intelligence has really taken over a lot of the coding world. Now the task is you need to know enough about coding to manage and implement what results AI might give you. But a lot of the heavy lifting of computer coding is now done by AI.
Does North Dakota currently have standards or rules governing generative AI use in schools, or are those decisions primarily being made by teachers and local school districts?
Yeah, I think it's mostly with school districts, school boards, administrators. Students, of course, are not encouraged AI to do their homework. It's a quickly evolving technology. One thing that Levi Bachmeier said is that, you know, he doesn't expect schools to implement courses in how to use AI. It'll just be kind of incorporated into whatever course they might be taking, whether it's math or even English. You know, there could be some use. A lot of it is about being upfront about that. If you did use AI to do some research, you need to be noting that, show your work, kind of a thing with how you used AI to get it. Because AI, using the right prompts and things to get the right results from what you're searching for from AI, is a skill. That's a skill that students probably will need to learn as they go into college and or whatever career field they enter.
Jeff, under Bachmeier's preferred approach, what decisions then would remain at the local level? And would any be guardrailed, so to speak, from state policy?
Well, from Levi's point of view, I think it, you know, almost all the decisions would be up to local control, up to school boards, up to administrators, up to classroom teachers. One of the guardrails that he actually has kind of encouraged is software that helps teachers and parents kind of monitor screen time and computer time so that students don't spend too much time searching the internet, interacting with chatbots, put some guardrails up to maintain that balance of human interaction and using a computer and research. You know, the cell phone ban that went into North Dakota during school hours has been pretty well received. And he doesn't want, once kids get out of school, to spend all their time on a screen again after school.
We're going to talk more about exactly that here in just a moment with one of your colleagues, Michael Ochterlein. We'll get into the use of screen time after school on school-provided devices. Before we go, Jeff, did you hear disagreement or uncertainty among lawmakers and education officials relative to this discussion?
No, I think it was pretty well received. I mean, whether they follow Superintendent Bachmeyer's advice to the letter, I don't know. They may have constituents that have other thoughts and maybe other thoughts of their own. But there wasn't a lot of pushback against what Levi presented, at least in that particular committee.
Jeff Beach, he's the deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor and visits with us periodically on A Closer Look with the Monitor. His reporting includes Regulate AI Companies, Not AI in Schools, North Dakota State Superintendent says, and Public Asked to Weigh In on Technology Use in North Dakota Schools. Jeff, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
A Closer Look with the Monitor continues. Of course, it's our weekly conversation with reporters from the North Dakota Monitor, and I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. As Jeff Beach just reported moments ago, North Dakota's ban on student cell phone use has changed the atmosphere in many public schools, but it's also directed new attention towards the laptops, the tablets, and other devices provided by the schools themselves. More than 2,200 people responded to a statewide education survey earlier this summer. Well, about two-thirds said technology is very important for teaching and learning. Respondents were divided over when students should receive school-issued devices and how much time they should spend using them. State lawmakers are now discussing possible limits. One proposal being developed for the upcoming 2027 legislative session could establish screen time guidelines based on grade level, restrict when school-owned devices may be taken home, and give parents access to information about how those devices are being used. Michael Ochterling is a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. He examined the survey results and the debate over how North Dakota schools can use technology as a tool without allowing it to become a distraction. Michael joins us for a closer look with the Monitor. How are you, Michael?
Wonderful, Craig. Thank you so much for having us today.
Pleased that you are with us. North Dakota, as I noted, has already banned student cell phone use during the school day. What happened after that ban turned attention toward school-issued laptops and tablets?
The one thing that's important about the cell phone ban, go talk to a teacher about it, and they will tell you that it did help, curb people using their phones, chatting between each other, and just kind of being on them as a distraction. It stopped the warring between teachers and students and parents, like, oh, it's the law. And so it actually had a very positive effect. So if you ask a teacher, more often than not, I would imagine that they would say it had a positive effect. But here's the thing. Once that happened, the school-owned devices, the laptops that all these students get, when they go to school to do schoolwork on, they're finding ways to use what they had been doing on their cell phones on these school-owned laptops. And one teacher did tell me that, one of the first things a student will learn is the quick key for minimization in a browser window. So the teacher's coming by and you hit that that quick key and it quickly minimizes your window. And so really cell phone behavior has migrated over to the school-owned devices and laptops that they're using for their schoolwork, which causes its own set of problems and kind of shifts, the device use to the laptop instead of what was on the cell phone.
So a few thousand people participated in the state's community survey on education. When respondents were asked about the greatest challenges facing North Dakota schools, was this part of what rose to the top?
One question was, what are the biggest technology challenges for K-12 in North Dakota schools right now? And 44% of those respondents said addressing student well-being concerns related to social media and screen time. Next on that list at 43%, right behind, was AI, and then cyberbullying at 39%, and then cell phone use still coming up on this survey. But yeah, the social media and screen time was the highest concern in this survey.
Was classroom tech among those concerns, and how this stuff is being used, as you kind of pointed out earlier, in the classroom?
Not the classroom tech specifically in this survey. Definitely parents were worried about social media and screen time for their kids on, at school. Like we said, like once the cell phones went away, things just kind of migrated to these school-owned devices and laptops.
Michael, your reporting indicated that two-thirds of respondents said access to technology is important for teaching and learning. What benefits do they see in keeping tech in the classroom?
The parents do see the benefit of being able to use tech. The majority of parents do not want their students cut off from tech, and they want them to be able to access tech. It's just, when should that be introduced? How much should they be using this tech? What should be the basis for kind of a tech education and usability while they're in K-12?
The respondents were divided over when students should begin receiving school-issued devices. What did the responses reveal?
It's kind of interesting because there was nothing that rose above a majority. The highest plurality, about 43% of respondents, said that tech use for their students should start in junior high or middle school. 26% for high school was when the tech use should start was the next highest response. The lowest one, though, is 5% as soon as they start school, and 12% said the middle of elementary school, about third grade. So it's seems like parents and the people that responded to this survey do want tech to be starting a little bit later than it is right now. Also, I'll point out that almost 13% of the respondents said that they should never have access to these technology devices. So, but a strong plurality thinks, right around the start of junior high and middle school is probably the right time. But again, that's actually a little bit later than when students are getting this tech right now. So that would be a change.
So Senator Axman is developing legislation for 2027. What kind of screen time limits is she considering?
Well, okay, so that's interesting. There are a few different facets to kind of her proposal. And obviously, we'll give a large caveat here. This is a proposal for the 2027 legislative session, so there's still a few months to go here. And so there's plenty of time for refinement. So this is just kind of the higher overarching points. We haven't seen the bill draft yet. I did have her give me a rundown. What she's including in her bill is it would be a limit on the screen time on these school-owned devices depending on what grade you're in. So like some of the lower grades, maybe only 30 minutes of screen time per day. Some of the higher ones, maybe up to 90 minutes. But I mean, that can really vary. And I don't think that's in stone yet and still up for discussion. But there would be a variance depending on what grade you were in and how much they want you to use these school-owned devices.
Your reporting says that the senator said that some students use these school devices late at night. Well, to watch YouTube or access other entertainment. Do we know how widespread that problem appears to be?
We don't know particularly how widespread it is, but it does make sense where let's say you have a student that didn't have a laptop. Their parents didn't get them a laptop. Maybe they don't have access to a computer at the home. The school gives them this school owned laptop and they take it home with them, and yeah, they'll do their schoolwork on it, but then they can use it for other things. And then there's other scenarios where, maybe they do have a laptop of their own, but maybe the parents have put monitoring or blocked some sites on that laptop. The school owned devices don't have that. And so it's kind of a way around, being able to look at what you want to look at. And yeah, it can be just watching YouTube videos, visiting these sites. So we don't really know how widespread it is, but it definitely it does happen.
Michael, Senator Axman's proposal could give parents access to information about their child's screen time and online activity. First, I'm surprised that that's not already the de facto standard, but what would parents or should parents be able to see?
Well, right. So Senator Axman said that, one of the interesting things is they do already have this platform and the ability to log in and see, how much screen time a specific laptop is getting and, what sites they're visiting. So now it's just kind of allowing parents to log in and see their child's school-owned laptop. They'll be able to see how much screen time they are spending on that laptop, and they'll also be able to see the sites that they are visiting. So, not really new, but more expansive, and they're encouraging parents to be a little bit more proactive in their students' screen time.
You visited with Superintendent Levi Backmeyer, who says technology should promote active engagement rather than passive distraction. What does that distinction look like in an actual classroom, and what did the superintendent have to say?
I thought it was a wonderful phrase that he brought out there. The active engagement is they want to use these devices to promote learning, to promote a process of getting how to do something into your head, and so you'll be able to use that going forward, not just become a passive distraction, which I think. Some modules that maybe kids are doing on their school-owned devices. Talking with a middle school teacher yesterday, you know, some of the modules that they're doing are almost gamified, you know, like they play like games. You need to complete this, you get so many points, so many right answers, I'll get you this sort of badge, and you're trying to collect all the badges and get as much many points as you. And so they don't actually retain as much information when they're doing things like that, because they're trying to go to the next level. They're trying to quickly advance to the next level. It's not, I mean, yes, they're going through all the motions, but the information doesn't stick there. Whereas if you were using the device to actively learn how to do something, that it can help you along the way instead of just, you know, answering a question and getting points.
Are teachers, Michael, looking for statewide standards, or do they want individual classrooms and school districts to retain flexibility?
Well, that's a really good question. I think right now it depends on the school district. If this policy goes forward, it might be a little bit more uniform. But the teacher I spoke to, she's already planning on taking a step back from how much work she's assigning to these school-owned devices. One of her quotes that she ended up giving me was she wanted to make boredom fun again. Yeah, and I just love that, because a student finishes a project or an assignment, you know, they'll obviously, you know, go on to something else on their laptop, you know, that they want to see. Whereas she doesn't want that. She wants them to open up a book. She wants them to talk to their neighbor about how bored or how easy that assignment was. It's those little interactions that the kids are missing when they just have their heads in these laptops. And so, you know, she welcomed stepping back slightly from these school-owned devices and kind of promoting more in-face interaction and more person-to-person learning.
Is there more discussion to be had between now and the 2027 legislative session as Axman and other lawmakers turn these ideas into possible legislation?
Oh, I think so. I mean, we've got a few months here before the session. Another facet that I didn't really touch on in Axman's bill is they, you know, maybe trying to limit some of the virtual learning days, like for weather, maybe, you know, do those in person if we can make them up in their makeup days in person instead of virtual learning. It's really just trying to get them off the screen and eyes up on the teacher, because they do feel that the information does stick a little bit better when you're getting it directly eye to eye instead of through a screen.
Michael Ochterling is a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. His reporting examines how North Dakota education leaders and lawmakers may address screen time and the use of school-issued devices as they prepare for the 2027 legislative session. Michael, of course, reports for the North Dakota Monitor, a site that's always free, no subscriptions required, and certainly no paywalls. Michael, thank you again for joining us for a closer look with the Monitor.
Thank you so much, Craig. Sign up for our newsletter.
Still ahead on this Thursday's Main Street, we continue talking about technology. OpenAI is offering a more restricted ChatGPT experience for teenagers. Plus, how can a pin pass through a balloon without popping it? We'll visit with our friends from North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Plus, news director Dave Thompson and I review the news. That's all ahead on today's Main Street. We are glad that you are with us. It all follows this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Teenagers often use the same technology as adults, but should they receive the same version of it? OpenAI has now introduced a more restricted, they say, ChatGPT experience for users ages 13 to 17. It includes stronger safeguards around sensitive content, tools that attempt to estimate a user's age, and parental controls that can establish quiet hours or limit certain features. At the same time, Meta is defending itself in a landmark federal trial brought by 29 states. The states allege that Facebook and Instagram were designed to keep young people hooked and that Meta improperly collected data from children under 13. Meta is denying those allegations. The developments raise a larger question. What responsibilities do technology companies have when their users are children and teenagers? George Peck is our technology contributor, and he joins us with Tech with Peck.
Gee, now we only have 8 minutes left, man, after that intro.
We'll get on with it right away.
You know, man, what a topic, and what an interesting thing that these are both happening this week. And what I thought was interesting was I was doing a little bit of research on it. I probably wasn't fully aware that there were chat bots and AI bots that were designed and were interacting, not just with teens, but the discussion was with teens in a fully, okay, here's the word I learned today, anthropomorphic fashion. So anthropomorphic is giving human traits. This is on the AI overview, Craig. Human traits, shapes, or feelings to non-human things like animals, gods, or objects, or computer software. And the reason I want to talk about it is it's part of the discussion of the ChatGPT and the OpenAI teen-oriented chatbot or tool. But if I hear my my Amazon Echo one more time say, okie dokie, I'm going to throw it on the floor. If I hear it say, all righty then. If I hear it say, how are you doing today? Can you tell me your name? So it's like, you're a machine. You're not a human. You're not my friend. But apparently ChatGPT is a lot of teens' friends, and that's kind of scary. So yeah, this is going to be very interesting to see. And to me, I think one of the most interesting things is how OpenAI and the AI discerns a teen from a non-teen. How does it know?
Can they have reasonable safeguards to distinguish age, to distinguish even location when you have considered things like VPNs that we've talked about? Can they restrict or understand if someone really is under 18 years old? How reliable can that protection be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. How does it determine it? And the little bit of research I did was it does not ask a user, how old are you? I mean, it might, but it uses interactions and utterances to make an estimation. Interesting how effective that might be. I mean, the limit of my age test has been going to like a whiskey site, and there's a thing at the front that says, are you 21? And at one point I just wanted to see what happened, so I clicked no and it forwarded me to the Disney website. otherwise it went to the whiskey website. I'm assuming there's got to be a little bit more, you know, tech behind the determination. Certainly the Meta trial is going to be fascinating to see what steps it has taken and certainly will take post-trial and already to discern a teen from an adult. The other thing that was very interesting, just one more thing because I don't want to forget about it, was part of the ChatGPT for teens or whatever the product is to not simply provide text for a term paper, but try to determine when a term paper is being written or researched and provide, I believe the term was homework assets or, you know, something to this effect. It's going to be very interesting to see how it turns out.
What do you think about a different type of software being served to a teenager versus what's being served to you or someone who is 1 year older?
It's got to happen. It has to happen. I wish it didn't have to happen. I wish in a perfect world, someone who was age appropriate would only do age appropriate queries, would not be looking for sexual things, would not be looking for a sexual companion. It would be nice, right? But I think the real world indicates this is the problem and how do we resolve the problem? And it's complicated. So, and we're early on in the resolution process.
I mean, Meta, to me, through Facebook, introduced this concept of infinite scroll. On my Facebook feed, which I do engage in periodically, I always tell it not to serve Reels. Reels is that rabbit hole that I just personally don't want to go down into. But it's apparent to me, and should be apparent to everyone, that infinite scrolling is because they want you to stick with the software. They don't want you to have to click next. How they can possibly say they're not trying to get people to stay in their software for almost ever.
So we probably should just for a second stop and identify infinite scrolling. Now, I'll tell you my frustration with infinite scrolling isn't Facebook. It's when I want to see the about page for a website and it never shows up because the about link is always at the bottom of the page, but there's no bottom of the page. So, I mean, that's been the case is that, yes, I don't care if it's a website or Facebook or a social media site. As you get the scroll bar starts to move toward the bottom, and as it gets to the bottom, all of a sudden the scroll bar gets smaller and all of a sudden there's a whole lot more content.
One thing that I think that you've thought about, that I certainly have thought about, is I don't care what guardrails OpenAI or anyone else puts around their software, there are going to be some smart teens that are going to figure out how to get around them.
They already have. They already have. They'll probably do an OpenAI prompt. And if they form the prompt properly, it will immediately discard the rules. It's yes, that's the very interesting thing, the same way that we have many people of different ages doing things that they're not supposed to be doing, at least legally.
Can tech companies be trusted to police themselves when their business interests may reward and do reward greater engagement?
It's like any other business with any that similar question. I mean, it's a tech company or it's not a tech company. It's a car company. It's a snack company. Probably not. So Kellogg's is finally taking artificial coloring out of their cereals. They only did it when there was so much public pressure that they had no choice. I mean, that's a really silly side note, but that's an example of what ultimately drives a for-profit company to do something that may not necessarily be in their for-profit interest. So I'm dubious. Yeah.
If there's a parent who's listening tonight, from your perspective, what's a conversation they should have with their teenager about AI or social media? What would you ask them to maybe think about, especially now, George, since this tool is available for teens, perhaps from OpenAI?
I would simply say, from a perspective of friends, I have a neighbor across the street. They both the kids left for college today. There's now some empty nesters, but we grew up with those kids. And we talked a lot to them, you know, to them about this kind of stuff and just kind of life. And they were our friends on Facebook. And I would simply say, you know, if there's something that you need, maybe find a friend from school, you know, Bill, or are you still getting along with, you know, Jim, or, you know, who is it that you want to talk to? Talk to them. Don't talk to the chat bot. If there's something that you think that maybe I'm dad or mom, I want to talk to you. You got to build this relationship. We got another neighbor down the street who's got a very difficult, you know, relationship with a daughter. So these are hard things. And in some cases, parents are not equipped to give the right answers. So it's hard, but it's simply try to build that rapport. Try to find an alternative human rapport to depend on. And if nothing else, I'm going to go back to the same AI mantra, which is, just double check what you're hearing. Make sure it actually makes sense. Don't trust it automatically coming from the bot. Go look at another source. Make sure it really makes sense, just in general.
George Peck, he's our technology contributor. OpenAI now says the new teen experience is intended to give young people access to AI while providing age-appropriate protections. We'll have to watch this one, George.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it turns out.
Talk to you next week.
All right.
Right now in North Dakota, 1 in 4 adults is caring for someone they love. AARP offers a family caregiving guide with information, planning tools, and North Dakota resources for family caregivers. The guide is available at no cost at aarp.org/ndcarekit. Support for this announcement comes from AARP.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A pen passes through a balloon without popping it. A message written in invisible ink suddenly appears. A pair of scissors seems to attract metal. It may look like magic, but Alicia Kellum from North Dakota's Gateway to Science says every demonstration has a scientific explanation. Alicia, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you.
I'm ready for a magic show, Alicia.
Yes.
Of course, children are naturally drawn to the things that look impossible. How can the sense of wonder become an entry point for learning about science? How do you use that to really foster excitement?
Well, in our camps and clubs, we definitely want to get students engaged. And that's why North Dakota's Gateway to Science is all hands-on. And that's really how you engage learning. And so one of my favorite weeks of summer camp dealt with science is magic, but real, which is one of my favorite science quotes. What is science that blows your mind? And if you can show one of your campers that, or even an adult that, suddenly they're super interested, they are super engaged, and they want to learn more. So at the end of that week, our campers actually learned throughout the week and got to put on a magic science show for their parents and for other participants.
Let's start with the scissors that appear to attract metal. What's happening in that demonstration?
So when you take a pair of scissors, and I think a lot of people, my husband knows this as a mechanic, when you take a piece of metal and you rub it on a magnet, you're creating within that a magnet of the scissors. And so if you were to take a pair of scissors just that has the metal ends and you were to rub a magnet on it for about 60 seconds, you can do this in front of your participants or behind them so that they can't see it. And then you go to pick up things with those scissors. It shows, hey, the scissors are a metal, but there's actually that science behind it. When you use the metal and a magnet, it transfers the magnetic properties into the scissors.
I do not understand how I can push a pin into a balloon without causing the balloon to pop.
Yes, this one made me very
nervous.
Can you
tell me the secret there?
Absolutely. The sound of popping balloons makes me very nervous. And so I learned this one actually at this magic show that the students did. He had a balloon and he took a small pin or a tack and he stuck it into the balloon and it didn't pop. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. What he learned throughout the week is the properties of the balloon and how if you put a liquid inside of the balloon and you poke the pin where the liquid is, when that energy is dispersed, it does not disperse it in the same way that the balloon pops. It actually disperses it because there is a weight pushing down on it and it won't actually pop the balloon. But then of course, he had to pop the top to show that where the water wasn't, to show that it really was a real balloon.
I'm thinking now of a spy novel with our next idea here with Invisible Ink. It's a classic experiment using lemon juice and heat. I think I've actually done this back when I was a kid. Why does the writing remain hidden at first and then what causes it to appear?
Well, lemon juice, if you write with lemon juice on a piece of paper and let it dry, lemon juice is clear. And so whenever you apply heat, so you think about applying heat, applying cold, applying pressure, these are all scientific principles. When you apply heat to the underside of that piece of paper, in this case, you could use, we used a hair dryer, which takes a little longer, but you can use a flame. That lemon juice where you wrote actually shows up much darker because of the chemical properties on the paper, whereas the rest of the paper stays white. This is a huge crowd pleaser with students because anything spy related is a really big deal.
Steel wool can create a surprisingly bright firework-like effect. What chemical reaction do we get to see when we use steel wool?
Firework science is my favorite. Being able to determine the different colors based on the different chemicals that you use. And it's something that we've done during New Year's Eve. We had a demo. It was very, very fun. When you take a piece of steel wool and you set it on fire just with a lighter, there is this crackling, beautiful sensation that sort of happens. You can't hear it, but the heat actually travels and disperses through the steel wool. And it is absolutely beautiful. It's like a bunch of ribbons that go through that are glowing. And whenever you think of fireworks, when you see the type of fireworks that go up and then slowly fall down to earth, it's kind of my favorite. It looks like a willow tree. This is that exact same science.
Alicia, you also have a demonstration involving paper wrapped around a glass that doesn't catch fire like you would anticipate. What protects the paper from burning?
This one was really interesting, and I thought it was a really fun demonstration. If you take a piece of paper over an open flame, obviously it catches on fire. If you take that piece of paper and you wrap it around a glass and you put the flame on, say, the underside of the paper, it does not catch fire. It starts turning dark, but it will not catch fire. It will take quite a bit longer in order to do so. It is because of the lack of oxygen that is surrounding. Obviously, if it is next to the cup, then it doesn't have that oxygen on the other side of it. And so you can hold it up for the exact same amount of time and one will catch fire immediately and one won't.
Finally, the ink and leaf demonstration. What can that reveal about the structure of a leaf?
This one was really interesting. It's making a leaf that is basically a self-propelled boat. And so what happens is if you take a leaf and you add some ink to the back of the leaf, as the ink slowly dissipates into the water, the leaf will propel itself around. And sometimes it spins around in circles. It goes pretty quickly. And what's happening is as that ink is entering the water, It is disrupting the top of the water, which we know that whenever you, for instance, those bugs that can walk on water, they use their weight and they spread it out and disperse it evenly. This actually dissipates that and moves the leaf forward, making it look like the leaf is moving around on its own like a little boat.
There are some of the experience that might be appropriate for families to try at home, but certainly should be done with adult supervision.
Definitely. That's why we have wonderful camp staff. We do obviously give those students some warnings as they go home, but we love to give parents and grandparents these amazing ideas so they can get their kids involved in science.
The wonder may feel like magic, but the explanation is science. Alicia Kellum is with North Dakota's Gateway to Science, where visitors are encouraged to experiment, ask questions, and discover why the world behaves as it does. Alicia, thanks for the work that you do, and thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home with All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live with host Jeremy Hobson.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
We welcome our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson, to Main Street on this Thursday. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Craig. How are you?
Well, I'm wondering if I shouldn't drive as fast.
Yeah.
The 2027 legislature will be asked to increase penalties for speeding and other traffic offenses.
It goes back. Law enforcement has tried this in other sessions, but now they have a lot more data on what's been happening out there. North Dakota has not raised its fine or points against your license in 50 years. So they say it's time now. And given what our neighboring states are doing, especially Minnesota and South Dakota, we're very cheap. So it's talking about we need to get rid of distracted driving, get people to back off and not tailgate people and obey the speed limits. So they're going to go to the legislature and ask for increased fines. It doesn't get to the level of a Minnesota or South Dakota, but it's probably overdue.
You know, with cruise control and adaptive cruise control, few of us have real excuses, I think, to not obey the traffic signs.
I think you're right.
Dave, the North Dakota SNAP program is encouraging healthier food choices for its recipients. How's it doing that?
Well, it's doing that because they have basically said that they will not allow you to use your electronic benefits transfer card to buy something like, you know, sugared soda pop or candy and things like that. They're trying to make North Dakota healthier that way. And it's something that, you know, we all knew was coming because after we got the federal grant for improving rural health, that was one of the pillars that they had, is to make people or help people eat healthy. And now they're going to cut down on it. So,
Dave, now that the Fargo-Moorhead flood diversion system is about complete, the Farm Bill now may include crop loss programs for upstream producers impacted if there's ever a flood and if the system has to be used.
That makes a lot of sense because farmland will have to be given up, you know, in order to have reservoirs to prevent some of the high water from getting into the Red or the Cheyenne. I know our congressional delegation worked pretty hard on getting that to happen. So it says May. It hasn't passed yet. So we'll have to watch this. But I think Senator Hovind is pretty confident that they'll get something in the farm bill because farmers will have to sacrifice maybe some crop years if we have severe flooding like we had in 1997.
Let's hope that doesn't happen anytime soon for sure.
Absolutely.
Dave, lawmakers want the public involved as they pursue future nuclear power options and the nuclear power industry. What's new there?
What is new there is that nuclear has a bad rap going back to Three Mile Island. And there's also been a lot of talk about what do you do with spent nuclear fuel? It was all supposed to go to a mountain in Nevada, but that's not happening. So some of the spent nuclear fuel is being stored on site at power plants. So there's a lot of concerns going forward, and there's wonder about radiation and things like that. So what they are trying to tell people and companies. If they're going to bring in nuclear energy, you should meet with communities where you're going to put the nuclear reactors to make sure that everybody understands what's going on and to make sure it's being done safely.
Dave, what's the latest on the upcoming special session that starts here September 2nd?
Well, we have a couple interesting things happen. There are bills that would probably, one, Kratom was the big thing. Kratom was talking about, you know, banning it. And I know at one point there's a representative from Bismarck who said, let's just ban the synthetic stuff because that's the really bad stuff. But now there's some backlash, and there might be a bill saying we just ought to ban Kratom, period. So watch for that and the argument and the discussion on that. Also, there are things about, you know, funding for the military museum, a Bank of North Dakota line of credit to help it get built, or, you know, to make sure that the bank gets paid back when the fundraising picks up again. So there are a few things like that, but, you know, a lot of it's just cleanup legislation, and I have a feeling that they will get done in 3 days.
Dave Thompson, he and I review the news on Thursdays here on Main Street. Always great to visit with you, Dave.
Thanks, Craig. Appreciate it. I'll tell you a story about a little
fella. This is Dakota Datebook for August 20th. Society columns were once a popular feature in newspapers. Here are some examples from this date in 1892 from the Fargo Society column of the Wisconsin Afro-American. Mrs. Ella J. Johnson keeps a fashionable dressmaking establishment at 43 NP Avenue. Every lady should give her a call. There will be services at the First Baptist Church next Sunday afternoon, preaching by Reverend Alex Moore. The Wisconsin Afro-American can be bought at Nathan Norris's Barber, 63½ Broadway. Nathan Norris's barbershop would probably have been upstairs or downstairs of Siegel Clothing Company, a men's clothing store at 63 Broadway. The column went on to report, Mr. George Hayes is quite an artist with the guitar. Mr. John Spencer made a flying trip to Jimtown and returned in 6 hours. The whole distance is 180 miles. Mr. James Woodfork left last night for Chicago. The Wisconsin Afro-American's previous issue on August 13th reported, Mr. Arthur Johnson is organizing his baseball team, the Blue Caps, and he bets that they can beat anything in the North. Also, Mr. Ford presented his daughter, Miss Alberta, with a fine Halen piano, one of the finest in the Northwest. The Afro-American community of Fargo was so prominent that it merited a society column from several Afro-American newspapers. These newspapers included the Wisconsin Afro-American, printed in Milwaukee, the Appeal, printed in Minneapolis, and the World, also printed in Minneapolis. 3 years earlier, on March 2, 1889, The Appeal had reported Mr. Amos Thomas left Monday night for Washington, in company with W.T. Montgomery, the large farmer in Christine, Dakota. Mr. Montgomery is the largest colored farmer in the Northwest. 4 years later, on June 27, 1896, The World would report, The young men of this city will organize a baseball club Thursday night. And Mrs. Anthony started to build her new residence on the north side Wednesday, and when it is completed, it will be an exceedingly nice one. These snippets about the routine daily lives of Afro-Americans from 19th century Fargo provide an interesting window into that era long ago. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that wraps up this Thursday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Monday on Main Street, we'll celebrate North Dakota's writers and artists and preview the North Dakota Book and Arts Festival, which is coming to Jamestown in September. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again Monday, right here on Main Street.